everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Retro Raw Rundown here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh. Join as always when we do these retro shows by Sondra. And if you're watching along with us on the WWE Network, it is episode number 307. Hi, Sondra, how are you?
Hi, Kenny. I'm doing all right. I'm still, you know, recovering from the Viking experience last night.
Well, we will get to that on this week's Inside the Ropes podcast.
I'm so excited for this week's Inside the Ropes podcast because nothing has brought me more joy in wrestling in such a long time than the Viking experience. Like, it's just the best. But I'm enjoying wrestling. Twitter has just been a joy today, and I think that's delightful. And there's chloroform on this episode of Retro Raw, so really, things are looking up.
Yeah. I mean, I wish that someone maybe a couple of days ago had chloroformed me to take me out of commission for a couple of days, but you know, you can't win them all. So, let's get right into it. We've got the April 12th, 1999 episode of Raw. I go through the heats that happened beforehand. So on the Hulk's drinking water, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you hear that noise.
I imagine him being adorable.
He is. He's awake. So he's even adorable when he sleeps. Don't know how he does it. Anyway, so on the Sunday night heat before this episode, we had, it was actually quite a good continuation of the story, because Ken Shamrock is raging about what happened to Ryan Shamrock last week. So he then ends up facing Midian, and he keeps smacking Midian around, saying, what have you done with Ryan, what have you done with Ryan, what have you done with Ryan? Ken Shamrock wins with an ankle lock. Midian still won't divulge where his sister is. Shamrock just continues smashing objects and stuff, and in the end, Undertaker ends up doing one of his mad promos that you love over the Tron. But it was a nice continuation of the story with Shamrock and the fact that he cares about his sister, sometimes too much.
Yes. But this isn't like overprotective Ken Shamrock. This is a legitimate concern. Like, if I had a sister and she were kidnapped and potentially sacrificed to some sort of dark overlord, you know, I would have an issue with that. That's fair.
I won't go into everything that happened on the show because it wasn't that eventful. We did hear JR tell us that he'd be returning as the announcer on Raw starting tomorrow. So no more Dr. Destiny Williams angle. Just dropped because, funnily enough, Sondra, it didn't work.
Strange that.
And then we also had Kane and X-Pac retain the tag team titles against the New Age Outlaws and Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart as well. So there you go. We kick off this episode of Raw, April 12th, 1999. JR and the King are back together. Did you care, Sondra? Did it give you any warm, nuzzly feelings? Did you feel sorry for Michael Cole? Where were your emotions going when you realized it was back to JR and the King?
I did feel sorry for Michael Cole, and I was confused. Like, I wondered if there was any lead up to JR just kind of having his job back. I mean, I know that we've seen on the show he's been campaigning to get his job back, so it seems like it should have been more of a like presentation, like, here, you are back.
Essentially what happened,
table.
He was in the ring with a microphone on heat, and he said, I'm going to be back in Instant Raw tomorrow night. And then brought Mick Foley as his guest.
And that's just it. Like,
that was it.
It almost seems like he should have been like presented with his commentary chair or something like that. You know, like him coming back because they've made a storyline out of it. It kind of seems like it should have been more of an event. But I mean, whatever. I just don't even really know. I'm not sad that the Dr. Death Steve Williams angle is dropped, although I'm a little sad about it because it was so shit. Like, it was kind of NWA level for me, where I just kind of enjoyed the antics of, you know, uncool dad Dr. Death Steve Williams going to frat houses and hanging out with JR. So I'm a little bit bummed about that, but it's good to have JR back on commentary. I do feel bad for Michael Cole because I think, you know, they take digs at him on the show too. They said something about like Michael Cole sucking at his job or whatever. And it's unfortunate because Michael Cole obviously isn't as experienced as Jim Ross at this point. I don't think he's a terrible commentator. I know a lot of people disagree. A lot of people think that Michael Cole was absolutely awful. And I don't think he was the greatest, but I think there are a lot of weird things that JR says too. A lot of things you could nitpick about JR's commentary. And I think Michael Cole was never put in a position to succeed, and he was never put in a position where he could learn and improve and do better. And they seem to just kind of have swept the legs out from under him.
It's a pretty accurate depiction of what happened. But okay, well, let's get into this episode because there's a lot to discuss. And we open the show with the corporation. Shane's got them all there. The Mean Street Posse are there. Shamrock takes the mic to talk about what happened with Ryan. And then eventually Shane tries to coax Stephanie to come out to the ring. So Vince brings Stephanie out because he's just not letting her go anywhere, Sandra.
No, not at all.
Because you never know when an abduction could take place. So there was that. And Hulk is trying to get me to play with him. I can't play with you right now. I apologize. Take your rope. Go away.
Sorry, Hulk. I need your dad for like a little bit of time. You'll get him back soon.
He's literally looking at me as if to say, why though? Vince and Stephanie come out. And it ends up kind of getting into like Shane's talking about how Vince's priorities are skewed. And, you know, he's not the Vince McMahon that he used to be. And then Shane kind of does a long promo about like his dad running the corporation at the ground and all this kind of stuff. He fires Briscoe and Patterson. Vince is kind of just watching all of this happen, which is quite strange. And then Shane ends up slapping Vince, and Vince and Stephanie walk off as Shane McMahon kind of stands tall. What did you make of all this? There's a lot of stuff to do in one segment, and it's all McMahon's, so it probably isn't going to be right up your alley, but what did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very long segment, and it seemed strange, because the show kind of opens, right, and Vince and Stephanie are sitting backstage with some, you know, armed, independent wrestling talent dressed as police officers, and, you know, it's just strange. Like, I don't understand why Vince keeps bringing Stephanie to Raw and putting her in this position. Like, I know when she was at home, The Undertaker kind of invaded their house, but it really seems like she's in more danger being at Raw. Like, I still maintain, why don't you send Linda and Stephanie to a spa somewhere for a while until The Undertaker calms down and then, you know, send them to an undisclosed location? If she's at Raw, if she's in the building, then she is going to be vulnerable. But it also, like, it's a little bit creepy to me, the infantilizing of Stephanie McMahon, because they're acting like she's an actual child, right? Like, they're really treating her like she's 12 or 13 years old, because she's sitting there and she just has this like dopey look on her face. Like, oh my gosh, I'm Stephanie McMahon and I'm just so overwhelmed by all of the danger. And then Vince is like, you know, it's okay, Stephanie, you know, be with me. And she's like, as long as I'm with you, Dad. It's creepy, right? I'm not the only one that thinks this is kind of creepy. And then
it's far more creepy 20 years later watching it back. Far more creepy.
Like, it just, there's something very off-putting about the whole thing. I mean, knowing that she's in her early 20s at this point. It's not like she's not a grown adult. She's a grown adult. But the whole, like, teddy bear imagery and all of the, you know, like, Vince is hovering over her as if trying to protect her. And, like, I understand. I mean, like, my dad would still do plenty to protect me if he thought I was going to be kidnapped and sacrificed to a Dark Lord, I'm sure. But I wouldn't be, like, dopily, like, hanging out and be like, it's okay, Dad, as long as I'm with you. Like, it's just creepy to me, and I don't like it. And then when Shane McMahon brings them out, I don't really understand why Stephanie had to be there for that conversation, because a lot of it seemed to be a lot more like about the power dynamic between Vince and Shane than actually having to do with Stephanie McMahon. So I guess if he wanted to bring Vince out to talk to him and Stephanie can't go anywhere without her father, then fine. But he specifically called out Stephanie to come to the ring, which I didn't really understand the logic there. I think Shane McMahon is on an absolute power trip here, and he's very good at being a cretin. Like, this is Shane McMahon at his peak performance, because he's acting like a dick and it's so easy to boo him. And it's been interesting too, because like Vince McMahon still is... he's still Vince McMahon. He's still the evil overlord, the evil owner of the company. But it seems like Shane's really trying to take that mantle so they can make Vince McMahon more sympathetic over the Stephanie situation. And I mean, between Stephanie being like this damsel in distress and the whole Ryan Shamrock thing, I just feel like 1999 is women in refrigerators the year or something right now. Like, all of the women are being used as props to further the trauma and the story of the men, and it just really irks me the wrong way. Shane firing the Stooges, I don't understand how he can get away with that. That's another issue I have with it, is like the power dynamic here. I don't understand how Shane can be like, okay, Stooges, you're fired, because we don't need the geriatrics. Like, we have the Mean Street Posse instead of the Stooges. I think that's a great line. I think that's a hilarious dynamic. Like, I have two sweater vested friends and I don't need you old cunts anymore. But I don't understand how Shane can fire them. And Vince is just like, okay, there's nothing I can do about this situation. Like, the power dynamic is very confusing. Is it just that Vince doesn't care? I mean, Vince has never been great to the Stooges, so maybe he's just not standing up for them. I don't really know. Like, it was an effective opening segment to make Shane McMahon seem like an evil overlord, but there are some logical inconsistencies here.
And also there's the idea that, yeah, is it that Vince doesn't care? I mean, I got the sense anyway that Vince just, you know, his sole purpose was looking after Stephanie. And anything else, he just didn't have time to even let it get in his head. But you would think that his gay best pal of like 50 years getting fired in front of him would be something that he would, you know, make an exception for.
Yeah, like you'd think that he would at least protest, right? That he would be upset about it, that he would want to protect the Stooges or give them some sort of job or give them another role in the company or something like that. But all he's doing is just doting on Stephanie, who looks like she has no idea where she is or what she's doing. She actually kind of has the same vacant look that Ryan Shamrock had when she first came on the scene. Like, she's a better performer than Ryan Shamrock, but it's that same like, oh my gosh, I'm so innocent. You're not.
No, you're not. And then at the end of it, we have Shane slapped Vince. We know what's going to happen there. Did you also find it quite funny that Shane McMahon was trying to call Ken Shamrock Kenny?
Yeah.
At points, like, does he want to die?
Right? It really seems like he does want to die. Because, I mean, Ken Shamrock coming out, obviously, because he comes out at this point, right? And he's raging about Ryan because he's like, where's my sister? Where's my sister? And
he doesn't feel... Because the other thing is the corporation didn't come and help him.
Right, exactly. The corporation. Well, and the thing is, I don't necessarily understand why Ken Shamrock is going after Shane when... I think, didn't we learn last week that Vince offered Ryan Shamrock as a sacrifice in Stephanie's place? He should really be angry at Vince.
That's a fair point. I mean,
I guess Shane is now the de facto leader of the corporation because Vince keeps giving him control and seems okay with that. Like, all of this just seems really out of character for Vince McMahon. So it's kind of confusing. And it would probably be a lot more effective, too, if we hadn't had the Shane-Vince dissension around the time of Survivor Series that turned out to just be a ruse anyway. Like, because as I'm watching this, I'm like, okay, but we had Shane versus Vince, and we had, you know, Shane bring Steve Austin back to the company, and we had, you know, that kind of stuff happen. But oh no, they were in cahoots all along. So it's hard to actually trust anyone's motivation still, which is kind of one of the things I've been talking about in the show, like subverting expectations a little too much to the point where it's not like an interesting story twist. It just makes you not believe what you're seeing. I like Ken Shamrock a lot here. I like his intensity. I like the fact that he still cares about what happened to his sister, even though he's been awful to her, but at least he's trying to protect her from the evil, evil Undertaker. And we will get to that. But yeah, like, I think Ken Shamrock was really effective here. I mean, Shane McMahon is someone who loves to yell in the face of danger and do crazy things, right? Like, this is kind of the equivalent of jumping off Hell in a Cell. Yelling in Ken Shamrock's face is not a great plan.
And Ken ends up flipping them off, and I guess he's left the corporation. Shane's belittling him for walking out. And then we come back from break, and Vince McMahon is assuring, like, Vince is telling Shamrock, I'm okay, don't worry, wishes him good luck. So, I mean, I think what's good about it is it is leaving you with kind of questions to be answered, which is good. But it's just, do you get all the questions answered?
Do you care about those particular questions? I mean, there are questions. Is this when Vince leaves in the limo? They were like, he's leaving his own broadcast.
Yes.
Yeah. So, which was interesting, because I guess he's so concerned about Stephanie that he brought her to Raw, but only for like 20 minutes.
I mean, that's all I would show her. I'd show her 20 minutes, then back in the car. Go home.
It just seems like maybe just send her on a spa vacation.
I did love the glorious segment where The Rock goes out to get fresh air and Shane starts sniffing the air and says that he can smell it.
That was
so good. Next, we get Sable and Nicole Bass against Tori and Ivory. So basically, this all goes to shit when PMS comes down. And before anything can really happen, the Ministry's music cuts off by Nicole. And it's Undertaker's voice again doing a whole thing about Stephanie and all that kind of stuff. What did you make of this women's tag team match, inverted commas?
I mean, it was bad. It was obviously bad. I don't really understand why Sable and Nicole Bass are together. Like, it doesn't seem like Sable would necessarily want Nicole Bass around because Sable's so full of herself. So I don't really understand why Nicole Bass is loyal to Sable at this point. Is she paying her? Like, if Sable is paying her money to be a bodyguard, then I understand that. But none of it's really been explained all that well. I kind of like Nicole Bass. Like, I think she is a very effective killer monster here.
She's like a more effective Tamina.
She's like a more effective Tamina. Like, she has a very striking look, and she is very big and powerful, and Tori and Ivory kind of, like, bouncing off of her and stuff, I think was pretty effective. And, like, she, doesn't she, like, chokeslam Jacqueline at some point, or, like, grab her, and Jacqueline makes amazing facial expressions, and I don't know, she's just, like, her as a big monster killer, I think, could be very effective. It's hard watching the Nicole Bass segments because I don't know exactly what happens with her, but I know that I've always just kind of heard that the company was terrible to her and portrayed her, like, not great on television.
Because the thing is, even with someone, I'm going to be so careful with how I say this, even if someone with Nicole Bass's aesthetic rocked up today, I think there'd still be trouble with it, because it's like, you know, there's not many people in the world that look like her. You know, she's mm-hmm. a very masculine looking woman. And then we're taking about 20 years when, like, I mean, because when China came into WWF, that was the first ever time that I'd really seen, like, a female bodybuilder. Because mm-hmm. why would I have been looking for them? For right. a variety of reasons. So, but I do remember when Nicole Bass just turned up, and I was like, when I was a kid, I was just like, well, she's a man. She has to be a man. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, you didn't have any more, like...
Well, and that's what they said about China. I mean, remember when she first choked Marlena out? It was like, is that a man? That can't be a woman. And I feel like Nicole Bass is going to be subject to the same sorts of criticism and horrible, horrible comments. I think, like, Nicole Bass's aesthetic and masculine look, that's kind of what makes her badass to me. Like, I really, really like that she looks different than the other women. I like the fact that she can chuck them about. Like, it seems like they're starting to have the build for maybe an interesting women's division. I don't trust that we're going to get there anytime soon, but I would be interested in seeing more matchups, like, I don't know, Nicole Bass and Jacqueline or something like that. I don't know, like, and obviously it depends on the capabilities of the wrestlers too, because Nicole Bass had worked in ECW, but I don't know how much had she actually wrestled. Was she usually like a bodyguard, or was she like a wrestler?
I think she was usually a bodyguard. I could be wrong. I'm sure she just
kind of
she was just a
body. To China, because China hasn't done a ton of wrestling at this point either. But I think Nicole Bass could be a very effective bodyguard, and I think the dynamic with her and Sable could be interesting. I think it, if I have to guess, I'm guessing it leads to Sable saying some not very kind things, because Sable's so all about her own beauty and all about her own self-indulgence, and Nicole Bass is obviously not her ideal aesthetic of a woman. So I could see that going all kinds of places that could go very wrong. But I mean, I was kind of impressed with Nicole Bass in the segment. I was.
Yeah, she's very impressive. She is.
Like, PMS coming down, I don't really understand why everyone's just fighting. Like, that's another problem I have with the women's division at this point, is it seems to just be a whole bunch of bitches and all of them are crazy, you know? And that's a problem.
Well, the irony is that the original premise of PMS was that it was these women who had been wronged, who were going to get together to fight off the men that did it to them. And now they've become the stereotypes of what they were supposed to not be.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what I liked about them when they joined, before they were called PMS. But I liked that idea. I liked the idea of two women who were like, no, fuck these guys who were terrible to us. We're going to get retribution on them, stand on our own, and have our own autonomy. And now they've devolved into this stereotype of, oh, is it always that time of the month for you? Fuck off and die.
Up next is Stone Cold Steve Austin. He comes out, he's talking about Backlash and all that kind of stuff. He calls out The Rock. He wants his belt, and then we cut to The Rock on a bridge, and he reminds Austin of what he did to the Intercontinental title back in December of 97. But he wants Austin to find them. He's not going to throw it in the river. He wants Austin to find them. So Steve Austin is going to go to the harbor or the bay or whatever it is to get his belt. And do you know what? I commend Steve Austin for his lengths to want to have his own belt.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, The Rock throwing this one into the river or wherever they are right now, I'm not exactly sure, because I can't remember exactly where the Joe Louis Arena is in relation to the geography of Detroit. But yeah, like, him wanting to throw the belt in the water, it means even more because it is Austin's personalized belt, and it is the one that he got back from Vince McMahon that he wanted so badly, that Vince had over his mantle. And that's the whole, like, crux of the story, right? Like, that was supposed to be Vince's big retribution over Steve Austin, was he got that personalized Smoking Skull belt, and he had it as his trophy, and now Austin wants it back. And I like the kind of the continuity with The Rock and Austin and the Intercontinental Championship, because obviously the scene reminded me of that a whole lot. And I'm sure they mentioned it on the program, but I thought that was an interesting way to bring a previous feud into the current story. And it does kind of go on, obviously, for the entire episode. So we kind of keep cutting to The Rock doing various things with the belt and whatnot. So it made for an interesting story thread, too. And it makes Steve Austin a little bit more interesting because he has a goal and he has something to go after.
And go after it. I think the idea of like Austin before being the guy on the bridge with the belt and now it's Rock. It's a nice switching of roles.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Hulk has now jumped up onto a sofa because he's terrified of the floor.
As you do.
These are things you need to get through with puppies, everybody. Just be glad I don't have a baby.
Oh gosh.
So then we had, what did you make of Austin? The idea of Austin's promo with The Rock and taking it to the bridge, is that inventive fun or is that kind of unnecessary nonsense?
It's fine. I mean, The Rock is a dick and he has his belt and Austin wants the belt back. And it's, you know, like that's pro wrestling storytelling. It is nonsense in a way because Austin in the past hasn't really expressed that much interest in having like a physical thing. But I think because it's Austin's own belt and it is the one that reminds him of, you know, Vince McMahon having some sort of retribution over him, I think getting that belt back in his possession is going to be kind of the thing that cements him as champion and cements him as having victory over the Evil Corporation in the end. So yeah, it worked for me. It was fine.
Then we have Big Show versus Christian. The Undertaker orders Edge and Gangrel to leave, so Christian has to kind of pay his sentence on his own against the Big Show. Big Show, of course.
My question here. Why are we still punishing Christian?
I mean, you'd ask me to go into the Undertaker logic book.
Well, I mean, my thing is, though, you already, like, hung Christian up by his wrists and whipped him backstage. Like, he has been through penance already. Like, he has been through some stuff for you. So I just don't understand why this is still, like, let's harp on Christian hour. And, I mean, we get more into that at the end of the show, too. But I feel bad for Christian here.
Christian deserved better.
He did. I mean, like, yeah, he did. Because this is all because he told Ken Shamrock where Stephanie was, right?
Yep.
When he was in the ankle lock. So it just seems like you're still punishing him for something that he's already paid for.
Well, so from there, we see Big Show get the win very easily. Then we see, now this all takes place within about a 95-second period. We see Mankind down in the boiler room. Saying that Big Show will leave in a stretcher. Then we cut to Shane asking the Mean Street Posse to go after Mankind. Then we cut to The Rock pacing on the bridge. Then we come back to the Mean Street Posse running around the back of the arena. And then we come back to the Outlaws, Billy Gunn. 95 seconds.
It was a lot. It was a lot to handle. And I was kind of confused about the boiler room situation because is it earlier that Mankind arrives and is like, hey, where's the boiler room? Asking the front desk people because he's like, he's going to lock himself in a boiler room for 2 weeks until Big Show comes and finds him for their match at Backlash?
Pretty much.
So is he going to stay in the Joe Louis Arena the whole time? Like, which boiler room is he going to be in for 2 weeks? Because Raw is a moving, traveling program.
Maybe he's just got to deal with all the empty arenas. Oh my God, Hulk, you're fucking bone. maybe he had a deal with all the arenas across America that for every Raw, he would be in the boiler room at all points.
Which is fine, but that's not a boiler room that you're locking yourself in for 2 weeks, right? Like, the implication seemed like, I am going to be in this particular room for 2 weeks straight. And that's just not feasible if you're going to be on every program. But Mankind shenanigans are always fun. I love the idea that Shane sends the Mean Street Posse after Mankind because it really is kind of the reinvention of the Stooges, right? Like, remember when the Stooges had to go to the boiler room to try and find Mankind and calm him down after, you know, cult leader Vince McMahon was revealed to him. I love that Shane thinks that the Mean Street Posse are going to be the most effective. And Pete Gass looks so excited to go after Mankind. He looks so excited. He's like, yeah, let's do it. And, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, like, we can totally take Mankind because we're big, strong boys. it doesn't really work out well for them. But I love the antics of the Mean Street Posse. And Mankind is just, he's so good at subtle comedy and also making you feel a lot of feelings for him. He's just, he's an incredible performer.
He's a complex character.
He is.
That takes us into Billy Gunn versus Val Venus. Battle for, well, I mean, it's,
was this when we heard a woman screaming in the boiler room, or was that later?
I think that's later.
Okay.
Yeah, so Val Venus versus Billy Gunn. Of course, interference has to happen because Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart come down. They stomp on Billy Gunn. And then Road Dogg runs down. And the heels run off. And then Deborah's making eyes with Val. And then Jarrett ends up, you know, insisting that Deborah go backstage with him. Val's sad. I mean, again, they crammed a lot into what it was. But, I mean, I just feel like Deborah is smart enough to not go after Val Venus because she can see the perils of what I would do.
Oh, there is no way Deborah is going after Val Venus. Deborah is distracting Val Venus with her feminine wiles. That is exactly what she's doing. Did you notice Val Venus came out with a purple towel this week? Not a white one. He's changed up his wardrobe.
There you go.
But no, I mean, Val Venus is obviously very distracted by Deborah. I mean, he's like gyrating and rubbing himself at her. And she's just like, whatever, do what you're going to do. And Jeff Jarrett apparently gets jealous of this or whatever, because he, you know, insists that Deborah goes backstage. But Deborah was really just doing her job. Like, Deborah has distracted many men before on behalf of Jeff Jarrett, and it usually works. So I don't really understand why Jeff was upset, because it was distracting Val Venus, and so he wasn't, like, beating up Jeff Jarrett. Why are Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart upset with Billy Gunn?
Because the night before on Heat, the New Age Outlaws stopped them from winning back the tag team titles, I guess.
Okay. Because, yeah, not watching Heat, I was kind of confused why that was happening, because Billy Gunn and Road Dogg aren't really a tag team so much anymore. Like, Billy Gunn has been more of a singles wrestler. So it seemed weird that he was getting back involved with the tag division. But I guess the New Age Outlaws reuniting to have a feud with Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett is fine. It is what it is. I mean, Val Venus segments are never really going to be for me because he's a cretin. But it was nice to see Deborah get one up on him.
Then we have the Mean Street Posse is at the door to the boiler room. They run in, and we come back from the break, and Mankind has laid waste to all of them. And then he knocks them back out of the boiler room. This was just brilliant. Like, Mick Foley plays this so well. Like, he plays it seriously, but also tongue-in-cheek. And I thought this segment was great. The Mean Street Posse, all full of piss and vinegar, going into the boiler room, and then 2 minutes later, they're all laid out, easily, by a guy who has crippled knees.
I mean, the Mean Street Posse definitely have an overinflated sense of self, right? And I mean, similar to Shane McMahon. So, of course, they think that they can take on Mankind, but Mankind is Mankind, and he is a trained professional wrestler. He's a former WWF champion. He should absolutely be able to take on the Mean Street Posse, who are not trained wrestlers and who are not trained fighters and who have only grown up on the mean streets of Greenwich, bashing in mailboxes and things. So it makes sense to me that Mankind would get one up on them. And I'm sure this is when we hear, like, some sort of cry or something in the boiler room, right? Like, because the Mean Street Posse are all laid out, and then we come back and commentary's like, what was that? What could that have been? Was that a child or a female, or what was it?
It was 1999, which is not the answer you really want. So from there, I mean, I think I'm trying to remember when I was watching Heat, because the problem is I end up watching the Heat and reviewing that with Finn about 5 days before we do this, and it mucks me up, because then I'm like, oh, what Heat am I talking about now? What Raw am I talking about? And then there's the Raw from today, just to make it even easier.
It's a lot.
But anyway, we get Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett taking on the Acolytes. They're not yet the APA. And the match is pretty horrendous until the Brood run down to get a DQ. Thank God. The Acolytes are bad wrestlers.
They are bad wrestlers. They're terrible. Like, I enjoy Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett quite a lot. I think they're good wrestlers. Like, I mean, I didn't say Billy Gunn and Val Venus actually as a match was quite good. There are some good wrestlers on this program. The Acolytes are not two of them. They are terrible. And an Acolytes match is not something that I can say I paid a ton of attention to. Despite Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett doing their best, there's just not a whole lot you can do. So I'm trying to remember. So the Brood come down for disqualification. Do they attack the Acolytes, or do they attack Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett?
My mic is doing this horrendous thing. I will sort it in the edit, don't worry.
Okay.
2 seconds, hold on. Yeah, I mean, I think that the from what I remember, because I watched this like 3 days ago, the Brood hit the Acolytes because they wanted to get the disqualification win for their team.
Which makes sense. And because I'm
no, Sandra. No, it does not make sense.
It doesn't really.
They're being a faction with Edge and Gangrel are in a faction with the Acolytes.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense at all. I'm confused about the placement of the Brood on this show. Like, it's very clear that by the end of the show, the Brood and the Ministry are kind of separating, but it's just all this stuff in the middle. I didn't really even understand what the alignments were, because it seems like the Undertaker is still punishing Christian and the Brood's not very happy about it, but they're still part of the Ministry. But then they attack the, because I don't even remember the finish of this match. So if they attack the Acolytes so that they can get a win for their team, fine. But it seems like they don't normally care about wins and losses that much, so they would maybe want to attack Owen. I don't even know what's going on with this. It's all very confusing. I like a faction, but I like a faction when I know who's on what team.
I mean, if you thought that was confusing, up next comes The Undertaker out with Paul Bearer. Midian is holding Deborah as Undertaker strokes her chin and calls her pretty. He talks about how this is Vince McMahon's fault. Stephanie was to be the prize. Now Deborah will have to do it. But before he can do it, Ken Shamrock runs down with a baseball bat. Undertaker warns him that if you know he'll never see Ryan again if he hits him. Ryan's in the boiler room, of course, because where else would she be? Where else would Ryan Shamrock be? But in
of
the boiler room.
In the boiler room.
That Mick Foley also resides in.
And so, like, why wouldn't Mankind notice that Ryan Shamrock was in the boiler room if he's also in the boiler room?
I'm just saying.
This segment was very uncomfortable for me and kind of infuriating because, well, Deborah's performance in it is really weird because as she's being like choked and grabbed by the Undertaker, she almost has a smile, like she's almost enjoying it and almost looks like she was like getting off on it, which was strange because I'm pretty sure she was supposed to convey fear. But I can't say that I'm a big fan of the Undertaker just being like, well, I want this one woman, so I'm just going to attack all the women until I get the one I want. The Undertaker has just become a creepy misogynist asshole now, and that is not really helping his case with me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least now the idea is that the Undertaker's a heel.
At least he's a heel, but it's the whole thing, like, I mean, like I said, this is basically Women in Refrigerators, the episode, where the women are having trauma inflicted on them to further the stories of the men, or to further the emotional plight of the men. They're basically just prizes to be traded and kidnapped and sacrificed, and you're not getting a whole lot else on this show. And so that's just kind of frustrating because, you know, you have Ryan in the boiler room still kidnapped. You have him being awful to Deborah. Like, there's just a really creepy overtone of kidnapping all sorts of women as prizes.
Yeah, no, it's pretty uncomfortable. I'm trying to separate the, you know, like how horrendous a lot of the women's stuff is looking back now. Because it hasn't aged well, of course, because women have thankfully got a lot further ahead and closer to being treated like
proper people.
Like proper people.
Strange our demands.
I know, right? First you wanted to vote, then you wanted to where
we want to be able to drive and own property on our own. I mean, how dare we?
I did like the Deborah angle though, because it makes sense. That, you know, they want to sacrifice Stephanie, and they're going to keep grabbing all the women they find to basically threaten to sacrifice to get Stephanie. So, I mean, his logic is pretty good. It's just quite creepy to watch it take place and play out.
It's just problematic when you're, like, stealing an actual human person, and when that person is always going to be female because they are the prizes. Like, if he were, I don't know, kidnapping members of the corporation, like if he did this to the big boss man, or if he did this to Test or something like that, it would not have nearly as much a creepy overtone. But because it's like, I'm gonna just kidnap all the women, not all the people who are close to you, I don't like it.
It's bad. It's yeah. it's not a great look for women. In the end, Shamrock is pissed and he just decides to hit the Ministry anyway, and Undertaker basically runs away. So
I do love Valiant Ken Shamrock on this episode. I think Ken Shamrock has been great lately.
Yeah, they've really kind of reheated him again. Mm-hmm. And Shamrock and Undertaker, not the worst built feud of all time. Because, no. You know, there's a real reason you want to see Shamrock get to Taker. And we will see that at Backlash. The Rock's still waiting at the bridge. Then we get the Big Boss Man versus Goldust for the IC title. But the Godfather comes out. He says he's got some unfinished business with Goldust. Offers all the hoes to the Boss Man, who takes them and leaves. And Godfather proceeds to win the Intercontinental Championship with the whole train over Goldust. Any thoughts here, Sandra?
Okay, so what was the Godfather's unfinished business with Goldust?
They had a match either last week or on Heat, and it went to like a... Basically, I think Godfather had a title match against Goldust, and it didn't get settled. So that's his unfinished business, because he wanted to win the title.
So, I mean, again, I just question the fiscal responsibility of the Godfather as a pimp, right? Like, the economic model doesn't make sense to me. If he's bringing in five ladies to work for him and offering them for free, then, like, someone has to be paying them. And if the Big Boss Man is not paying for their services, then the Godfather has to be paying them for their services. But the Big Boss Man is not paying the Godfather either. So I just don't understand how this is a money-making venture. You say pimping ain't easy, but that's just because you don't know how to do it.
I've never thought about that. He is an exceptionally bad pimp.
He's terrible. He's terrible at what he's doing.
He gives women away for free and doesn't make any money from it.
That's what I'm saying. This has been my issue the whole time. And so, I mean, like, offering the women for free to the Big Boss Man, okay, fine. Like, he takes them, and I get it. Like, the Big Boss Man's not always the sharpest knife in the drawer, right? Like, the Big Boss Man is not very intelligent in some of these situations. Maybe he's still suffering from a little bit of, you know, oxygen deprivation from that time he was hanged 2 weeks ago to his doom, but he seems to be okay now. Like, how is the Big Boss Man just sort of back and walking around and like, yep, I'm going to fight for the Intercontinental Championship? I don't really know why Big Boss Man got an Intercontinental Championship shot in the first place, but, I mean... Everyone seems to get championship shots, so whatever. The Godfather's not stupid for offering the ladies to the Big Boss Man in exchange for the title shot. So at least that exchange, you know, I'm not a big fan of using women as property, but, you know, like, it makes sense from the Godfather's point of view, I suppose. But what I don't understand is after the Godfather wins the Intercontinental Championship, the hoes come back out to celebrate with him, and they all basically pile on him, and they act like they're going to go out and celebrate with the Godfather. Really, the Big Boss Man is not getting what he agreed to.
Well, I mean, maybe the Big Boss Man had his time with the ladies, and then that was them done.
Had his time with the ladies during the time of this, what, like, 3-minute match? How long was this match?
I don't know the exact... But listen, Sandra, it's a very bold accusation for you to come and even bring up a man's time here.
All I'm saying is that his agreement was that he got all five ladies for the entire night. And they, after like a few minutes after the Godfather wins, abandoned the Big Boss Man, abandoned their commitment, and went straight back to the Godfather, maybe hoping that they would get paid actual money because that is supposed to be their job.
I mean, I can't argue with your logic.
I'm just saying.
Poor Big Boss Man. I'm also melting because Hulk has fallen asleep beside me with a toy in his mouth.
You need to not podcast in the same room as him.
I know, but it's difficult. Okay, I'm trying to lure him in. That sounds bad. I'm not trying to lure him in. I'm trying to get it done so you can just be around and I don't need to worry about it. But it's a work in progress. Anyway, so then Shamrock ends up finding Ryan in the boiler room. Mankind's there. The Ministry are back. They're assaulting Ken Shamrock and Mankind. And then they're taken out, and Ryan Shamrock is... This is the bit, like... So as much as I, like, try to look at all the various sides of stuff, like, there is just no way that I can see or hear a squealing Ryan Shamrock being taunted by The Undertaker and not just feel like a rape's taking place.
a rape has just taken place. That is what has happened. That is the implication on this show. Commentary is talking about what has happened to Ryan Shamrock. She still doesn't get to speak her case. She still doesn't actually get to be a character. She is just the prize that has been raped and defiled by the Undertaker against her will. And it is incredibly uncomfortable to watch. Like, looking at her face and hearing her screams, she's actually gotten better as a performer since the time that she debuted. She hasn't been around a ton, but she's actually been kind of an effective character recently. And I find her to be a sympathetic character. And I find her to be an especially sympathetic character now because she was just stolen and assaulted against her will. Like, it's very upsetting to watch this. Like, just as someone who's been in certain situations, it's very uncomfortable to watch this and then hear commentary just like talking about, oh, you know, it's so terrible what the Undertaker's done to Ryan Shamrock. How will Ken respond? No. I'm not as concerned with Ken right now as I am with Ryan and making sure she's okay.
I guess it just kind of talks to how, like, so I feel like for as a guy, you don't really see how bad women had it because you were not a woman. But then when you, it's like going back and watching this sometimes, it's just like a real, like, oh yeah, that's why women didn't watch.
Yeah.
Or that's why some, but I think there was an audience of women who enjoyed it. But I think that was maybe the women that maybe enjoyed that were quite, they liked the roles that the women had. They were quite happy with those roles.
And I think there were a lot of female wrestling fans who enjoyed the wrestling too and might not have been happy with the representation of women but watched the show because they enjoyed wrestling.
Yeah.
So it's, because there was, it's a whole
there,
complex thing.
There was always like some characters that were good. Like Sunny was good. Sable was just an enigma for about a year. So there is the women's stuff is pretty interesting to see play out. This was probably the worst yet for me event that we've seen, just because everything else I can kind of like, if it's in a ring, I can kind of get away with it. Oh, it's a wrestling thing. But just hearing a woman scream is in like a boiler room is...
Well, and like if you compare Ryan Shamrock's reaction here to Stephanie McMahon's reaction when she got kidnapped, was that 2 weeks ago? Similar trauma, similar face. Like Ryan Shamrock doesn't have the symbol painted on her or whatever, but, you know, Stephanie McMahon talking about like what's happened to her and the Undertaker talking about what he's done to her and all that kind of stuff. I mean, the implication is that he is raping these women, and it is very uncomfortable to watch and very uncomfortable to be made a storyline just for the, you know, like rape a woman to teach a man a lesson. I really just don't like it.
Then we have the Hardcore Holly versus D'Lo Brown match for the Hardcore title. Al Snow is there, of course, because Al Snow will just not leave the Hardcore title alone. We just can't get rid of him now. He's just like a consistent zit that won't go away.
Didn't he have head dressed as Jerry Lawler?
He did. I'll give him that. That was something. So this is like another kind of bonkers hardcore match, as usual. Al Snow ends up getting involved. What do you think about the hardcore stuff? And Al Snow specifically, because Al Snow was someone you were really looking forward to coming into the WWF in June of 98, and now here we are in April of 99, and he just kind of feels like an annoyance on the card.
I'm not super sure why he's there. Like, I think Al Snow was kind of funny for a little while, but now, like, a lot of his matches haven't been great, and I don't really understand his obsession with the hardcore title. It seems like it's supposed to be just like Al Snow's a crazy person, right? And so he's going to do crazy things. And I guess the storyline here is still that he doesn't want anyone to beat Bob Holly for the hardcore championship except him. Like, he wants to face Hardcore Holly. I'm not super sure why. I don't really understand why. But that's just what he has gotten into his brain, and that's what he's going to accomplish. And so that's just the way it's going to be. But I guess that needs to be better explained to me, because I don't understand Al Snow's obsession with Hardcore Holly or with the Hardcore Championship when it wasn't like it was his to begin with. It was Mankind's. And is it just because they're pals? I don't really know. Like, I don't really know what he's doing. He doesn't bother me too much because there's a lot of stuff on the show that doesn't make sense. Like the Godfather versus Goldust, I was not a huge fan of. I don't know why the Godfather's Intercontinental Champion now when like Goldust just won it. And now the Godfather's the champion, and like, why is any of this happening? So Al Snow being obsessed with the Hardcore Championship is another just kind of like, why is this happening? Okay, I guess we're going with it. That's just the way things are.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I was watching it back then, I didn't really think of Al Snow as being particularly, like, I liked him. I quite liked the Job Squad, and I liked the Ad Head and stuff. But that was about it. But watching it back now, he's quite annoying. actually.
Like, are we meant to like Elsinore or dislike Elsinore?
I think we're meant to like him.
Okay, because it's hard to tell. And it's hard to tell with a lot of characters on this show. Like, genuinely, I think we're watching a program full of heels for the most part, right? Like, mankind
because the whole idea is,
sympathetic, and that's about it.
Well, because they want to do this kind of Shades of Grey thing to keep you guessing, but, like, you can do Shades of Grey so much, but, like, the things that have drawn the best ever in wrestling are black and white. Like, it's a very clear-cut thing, and only very rarely can you go Shades of Grey and have it be just as successful.
Yeah, and I mean, like, Shades of Grey can work as character motivation, but at the same time, it can all just kind of devolve into a big mass of nothing, right? Like, you want some bright spots, and you want some dark spots, and you need actual, like, I don't know, you need something to cling to, and it feels like a lot of the characters on Retro Raw right now, while they're over and they have storylines, their motivations aren't super clear, and no one's actually that likable, so it's hard to get behind them. I want someone that I can actually cheer and get behind, which is why I like that Ken Shamrock is being valiant again instead of, you know, a creepy overprotective monster. And, like, it's hard for me to really get behind Vince McMahon as a sympathetic character because of all of the stuff he's done in the past. So, I don't know, it's just, it's difficult. Like, basically, we have Mankind, and Mankind's my guy, and that's kind of it at this point. So,
So then we go to Rock still waiting down at the harbour. We then cut back to, I'm not even joking, Ken Shamrock is being sacrificed, essentially.
Well, because they chloroformed him backstage.
Yep.
They kidnapped Ken Shamrock after the segment where he tried to beat up the ministry. They got a hold of him, right? Was that what happened?
Yeah.
And then they take him backstage, and then there's chloroform, and Paul Bearer is there. And I am an advocate of chloroform in wrestling. Some of my favorite moments in wrestling history involve chloroform, like kidnapping Matt Stryker and The Undertaker and Giant Gonzalez. So I always get happy when there's chloroform in wrestling for some reason, even though it makes no sense and it's horrendous, but it's just one of those things. But yeah, Ken Shamrock has been sacrificed. Is this when he's on the symbol when they're nailing him to it tying him to it and everything? So having been chloroformed backstage, he has now been placed upon the symbol. They're trying to tie him to it. They did not iron his sacrificial robes. They're quite wrinkly, and it kind of bugged me a little bit. Why are they sacrificing Ken Shamrock?
Because he's trying to stop the sacrifice of Stephanie, and then he stopped the sacrifice of Deborah. So he's just basically getting in the way.
He is getting in the way. I do question the ministry and their sacrificial, like, methods, because when they tried to sacrifice Stone Cold Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin got out of the handcuffs and stuff, right? Like, he was able to break the ties and get down. Now, Ken Shamrock, they're trying to tie him to the symbol, and he's easily able to get out of the ropes as well. So I just don't think that they're very effective. If they want to keep someone on the symbol, they really need to up their game.
And I mean, The Undertaker, who's kind of went from, in the last month, is from being like, hey, I've got some information that might get me something, to hanging someone, to now...
He got better, though.
To now, like, kidnapping and abducting women?
Yep. That's exactly what's happening. And the Big Boss Man was able to get, like, pretty easily get out of the sacrifice thing, too. And he survived a hanging. Like, the ministry's just really ineffective at human sacrifice. aren't they shouting at this point to, like, who else did they want on the cross? Was it Ryan? Were they like, get her and put her on the symbol too?
That's all what it's about. It's all about the power play.
I don't understand how they're supposed to sacrifice both of them on the symbol at the same time if they can't even manage to tie one person to a symbol.
Maybe the will and the sort of like adrenaline would get them through.
Maybe. I just feel like she would escape.
Well, you know, she's a woman, so she might not think to escape.
That's true, and they have traumatized and beaten her, so there is that.
I hate this story. They just don't show this stuff on the highlight packages.
I wonder why.
Main event is X-Pac and Kane defending the tag team titles against Triple H and Test from the Corporation.
But they get out of it, right? Like, Ken Shamrock gets off the symbol. Isn't this when the Brood and the Ministry are, like, all fighting?
No, so basically, before the main event match, we have Undertaker standing as the Brood. The Brood are trying to keep him on the cross. And then, as is a brawl, the Undertaker disappears through the floor. And that's the cliffhanger. So we'll talk about all this bit now. Right? So then, after the match, we come back and see that Shamrock has been saved. And then Shamrock challenges Undertaker and calls him Mark. Lights go out, Undertaker's right behind him, decks Shamrock. But Shamrock rolls over, just beats the ever-loving shit out of Undertaker. Ministry try to pull him off. He keeps fighting, but in the end, he can't overcome like the 10 men that are trying to beat him up. Mm-hmm. So would you make of this final element of Undertaker and Shamrock? Did it save the day from the full rape earlier on the show, or?
I mean, it didn't exactly save the day from the full rape earlier on in the show. It does make me want to see Ken Shamrock beat up the Undertaker, so I guess that's effective. I mean, the whole thing was just really weird because there was so much going on, because there was all the stuff with the Brood too, and it was all getting really confusing. Like, Ken Shamrock calling the Undertaker Mark, you said that Vince McMahon called the Undertaker Mark in a segment on Heat recently as well. So it's very weird that they're breaking the fourth wall there, and they're just like, Mark, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing these things. And they're acting like Mark Calloway, the dude, has all of a sudden started really sacrificing people on television. But it's one of those things that doesn't break the fourth wall super effectively, because if this dude is actually doing human sacrifices and you don't want him to do it, then you should probably stop him, like, production-wise. Someone should step in and help them. So I don't know, like, explaining to someone that you're watching a TV show is not always the best idea if you want to suspend your disbelief, and so that doesn't necessarily work for me. But I like Ken Shamrock's intensity, and I like the fact that he is angry about stuff, and I want him to win.
I kind of forgot about the Undertaker and Shamrock stuff. Like, I knew it happened because I was watching it at the time, but I kind of forgot about it. And like I think I said this a couple of weeks ago, it's just one of those really odd matches that you think would never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just glad it does, because it's great.
I'm intrigued for sure.
So the main event match that we got, as I say, was Triple H and Test try to get the tag titles off X-Pac and Kane. But X-Pac and Kane, quite a good unit together, Sandra.
X-Pac and Kane are great. I love X-Pac and Kane as a team. I was hoping I would like them as a team, and I love them as a team. I think their dynamic is fantastic. Who was in this match again? It was Test and
Triple H against X-Pac and Kane.
I'm sorry, Triple H is just so boring that I forgot he existed. not lying. No, I mean, obviously I was going for X-Pac and Kane here, and I thought, you know, they did a good job in the match. Like, it was unfortunate every time Triple H wrestled, I just about fell asleep. I mean, I was watching it pretty late at night, but it does not help that it's Triple H and Test, and they're just so bad. And X-Pac and Kane are so good, and I love their dynamic. I like the idea that Kane still doesn't quite know if he can trust X-Pac, but they've already had a title defense under their belt, so it seems like they're kind of working their way toward trusting one another. Like, he actually kind of helps X-Pac, and they kind of help each other win a little bit. So we're getting slowly, like, they became tag team champions almost accidentally, right? Like, because didn't Kane press X-Pac and then drop him onto Owen Hart, and then that's how he pinned him? So it was almost like he was attacking X-Pac, but by virtue of his own strength, they won the tag team championships. And it seems like X-Pac really cares for Kane. And I want Kane to have someone in his life who truly cares for him, because after having his heart broken by China, and after the traumatizing childhood with Paul Bearer, he deserves some, you know, companionship in his life. And so I think that they're good for each other.
Well, X-Pac was the guy who months ago tried to get Kane to come and join DX.
He did. Like, X-Pac, as long as X-Pac's not actually speaking a whole bunch, X-Pac seems like a stand-up dude. As long as he's not talking about repping some ass and making some noise.
I'm with you, actually, about the Kane and X-Pac as a team. It's funny, because on this show, like, there was elements to the Ministry stuff that I quite liked, and there was elements to that I didn't. But at the same time, you've also got a story with X-Pac and Kane, it's kind of been building for a couple of months, and they're doing it very slowly. And like, even when they're, you know, like, I mean, I don't know if I would trust the main roster today to tell me a story of two kind of enemies who won the titles together and then slowly kind of developed a relationship. So,
I mean, it worked in 2012, 2013
with
Daniel Bryan and Kane.
Yeah, well, Kane is the what's the word? Common
the
factor.
The common denominator. I mean, I'm just saying that, like, I mean, 2012, 2013, it's been a little while, but it can be done, you know? And it worked with, I mean, Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens. They told that story. They didn't become champions, but it was still an unlikely friendship.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just trying to more give some props to I'm trying to give Russo props whenever something deserves it in my head. And I think with the X-Pac and Kane, he deserves some props.
I love this story. I just don't think it's fair to say that it couldn't happen nowadays when we've seen it happen nowadays.
We've not seen it happen in 5 years. 6 years. So.
Well, with Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens was more recent than that. I mean, they didn't win the championships, I guess, but...
So we got that tag match. In the end, Kane ends up doing a tombstone to Test after some shenanigans. So X-Pac and Kane retain their titles and all is right with the world, which leaves us to finish off the show by going back to the bridge. Austin arrives, he leaps out of the truck, starts hitting the rock, and Rock fires back, and then punches him over the bridge, and then pushes him off and throws the belt over. So The Rock has tried to murder Steve Austin.
Yep.
And thrown his belt away.
Yep. Because it can't be warm out there. Like, it's April and it's Michigan. So it's probably not warm. Like, we had snow 2 days ago. Like, actual full ground covered in snow. So, I mean, Austin's just dead in the water now? Is that what I'm meant to think? That The Rock has murdered him? I mean, the Big Boss Man survived a hanging a couple weeks ago, so I think he's going to be okay.
I mean, essentially, yeah, he tried to murder him and then tried to throw his belt away.
I am curious about the belt. I'm curious if they're able to retrieve the belt, because that belt is, I mean, like I said, the segments work for me because that belt specifically is the important thing. Like, it is kind of the MacGuffin that you just, that's the thing that Steve Austin wanted, was that particular belt. Like, being the champion is not necessarily enough without the belt. So, I don't know. I guess I am kind of mildly intrigued whether Austin's going to be able to get the belt back, whether he is, you know, going to recover from the death to still be the World Wrestling Federation champion. Lots of shenanigans. Why did The Rock have a fishing pole out on the bridge? Where did it come from?
To lure Austin.
Yeah.
Got a little bit somehow.
Apparently so.
So anyway, that's the end of the show. We see Austin fighting for his life. And the belt just kind of
We don't really
abandoned.
See him fighting for his life. We just see someone far away drop into the water, and then the belt gets thrown.
Yeah, it's but like the implication in the water. But the implication of the story is that that character has just been flung off a bridge.
Yes.
Where would your thumb be for this episode, Sandra?
So I wasn't bored watching the show. When I started watching this last night, I intended to watch a part of it because I was really tired. And I was like, I'm going to just, you know, try and get to about the halfway mark and then I'll turn it off. And then by the time I checked the time again, I only had about 10 minutes left. That's a good sign for the show because it means I wasn't bored during it, even with some of the dross in the middle. So I would be inclined to give it a thumbs up based on entertainment value, but I can't because of all of the rapey implications and all of the really, really terrible stories that are going on. I'm going to give it a thumbs in the middle. If the stories weren't about treating women as possessions, I would actually be a lot more into this episode of Raw, but there's just a lot of that nagging, like, hey, maybe let's treat women like people back in my head that I can't get over. But I mean, I did enjoy a lot of the shenanigans and stuff.
Yeah, I'm a thumbs in the middle as well. I really enjoyed the stuff with Shamrock against the Ministry. I thought it was really strong and really rebuilt him pretty well.
Are the Brood with the Ministry or not with the Ministry now?
I feel they're on their way out.
Because they, like, in the Ken Shamrock attack, the Brood starts attacking Christian. Sorry, this was one thing that stuck out because I'm such a big Brood fan, but, like, the Ministry starts attacking Christian again, right? And they're like, he's still paying for his sins. And the Brood actually rescues Christian from the Undertaker and the Acolytes and all of the other cretins that are there, and the Brood actually start fighting back on Christian's behalf, and I thought that was an important part of the episode.
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I thought there was a lot of good parts to the episode. The only reason I'm kind of giving it a thumbs in the middle is because I didn't realise how monumentally annoying Al Snow was, and then he really annoyed me in this episode. Like, I don't know why, just really annoyed me. I was just like, go away!
It's odd that that sticks out to you, but that's
Let other people fight for the belt. I can separate the whole, like, right, women were not treated well at this point in time, but I'm going to try and watch it within the confines of what it was supposed to be at the time, right? And I can try, most of the time I can kind of separate it, but the thing with Ryan screaming was just a bit too much, and those two things definitely made it a thumbs in the middle. But I didn't think it was a boring episode at all. It flew in. And then next week we're in the go home for Backlash.
Already? Mm-hmm. Wow. I kind of forget that Backlash is a pay-per-view that's happening. Like, it seems like it's just kind of come up really, really quick. And maybe that's just because we were dealing with WrestleMania in the year of our Lord 2019, and Retro Raw's WrestleMania was a little bit ago. So it just kind of seems like I'm not ready for another pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, enjoy Backlash, because the one after it is not really good.
Oh, no.
Over the Edge.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha.
So, trivia fact, actually, that Over the Edge was the only WWF pay-per-view event to never be released to home media.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Even, like, with it edited out, they basically ignore that event exists, but there is a title change on that show. So that has to be acknowledged, obviously, but they kind of mm-hmm. just ignore the show. Well, I mean,
it's understandable that they wouldn't want to release that.
I mean, yes. For completists like me, it would have been nice. But, you know,
And we have it on the network.
Great. I love non-physical, digital shite. Maybe you used to go and buy the thing, Sandra. You used to go to the shop and you used to buy the thing.
Yes, I enjoyed buying the thing. The problem is I have too many of the things because I bought too many of the things.
Well, yeah, the problem is that you still have your VHS tapes.
Yes. And there are a couple of them that I still watch.
Like?
Empire Records.
Mm-hmm. Great movie.
It's amazing. And the DVD is only the special edition, which makes a lot more sense because it has a lot of the cut scenes added back in. So you see, like, Gina give Corey the red bra and that kind of stuff. But I like the nonsensical 90-minute version where everything is just bonkers.
I mean, if you're watching Empire Records, that is what you're watching it for.
Exactly.
So. Okay, so Sandra, what are the plugs?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. Check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/InsideTheRopes for retro heat reviews with Kenny and Finn. Power Slam podcast one day early. Tons of bonus content. All of our pay-per-view reviews, both current and classic. So all sorts of bonus content on Patreon. YouTube.com/InsideTheRopes for tons of interview content. Lots of really fun stuff up there from WrestleMania week. So definitely worth checking out. And go to InsideTheRopes.co.uk/BookerT for tickets to An Evening with Booker T.
And one other thing, if you are a Patreon subscriber and you've got a $50 pledge podcast for us to still do, we will get to it, and we will do it in May, I promise. Just let me get these next 2 weeks out of the way, please.
Yes.
So we've got a bunch of them to do, but we'll get through them. So I think to play as it has to be Ken Shamrock, right? Because he owned this show,
and his theme is great, and he is great, and I love him.
Here's Ken Shamrock. Bye, everybody.
Bye.